Welcome to Relatively New Flute Music Monday with Dr. Tammy Evans-Yontz. I'm on faculty at Newberry College in Newberry, South Carolina, and the University of South Carolina, Aiken in Aiken, South Carolina. You can check out my website at www.tammyevansyontz.com, my online blogging community at www.musiccollective.org, and you can also follow me on Twitter at Tammy Evans-Yontz. The piece that we're going to be looking at this week is a night piece by Arthur Foote. This piece that I'm specifically looking at is for flute and piano, but originally this work was actually written for flute and strings, so we're going to be looking at that flute and piano arrangement today. Arthur Foote was born in 1853. He died in 1937, and he's an American composer. He is part of what's called the Second New England School of Composition, also known as the Boston Six, the Boston Classicists, or the Boston Academics. So several names for that particular group of composers. They lived, obviously, in the New England, Boston area. They were living in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And really, they kind of moved the United States into developing a more American style of composition. So previously, the classical music that was being written at that particular time sounded very European. So really, the American composers were just sort of continuing in that European tradition. And so then we start to see these composers writing in what eventually will become what is considered to be an American style of composition. And composers who would then follow this school would be composers such as Aaron Copland. So we're transitioning into that particular style. Arthur Foote studied at the New England Conservatory and at Harvard as well. At Harvard, he studied with John Knowles Payne, who was a prominent composer and sort of the unofficial head of the Second New England School of Composers. Foote received the first Master's of Arts degree in music at Harvard University and later did a little bit of studying in Paris. And as an organist, he was a founder of the American Guild of Organists. And as a teacher, he taught piano and then wrote several pedagogical books and also some books on harmony, which were used up until, as I understand it, relatively recently. Arthur Foote's music is very romantic in style compared to the composers who followed him. It's very lyrical, it's very expressive, and there's a really clear formal structure to it. And he did, during his lifetime, receive quite a bit of popularity with the piece that we're looking at today in its original form, so a night piece for flute and strings. Originally, this piece was written in 1922. It was taken from the Nocturne and Scherzo for flute and string quartet, which was written in 1918. And then later, it was arranged for flute and piano by Eleanor Zerov in 1973. Now, I haven't been able to really locate much information on her, but I did find what appears to be an obituary for her husband, and he apparently was a flutist in the Chicago area who played for the Lyric Opera Orchestra. The work is dedicated to Georges Laurent, who is a flutist in the Boston Symphony Orchestra from 1918 to 1952. So quite a considerable career there, and so no doubt Arthur Foote's and Georges Laurent's careers would have paths would have crossed because they were in that particular area at the same time. So looking at the work, at first glance, you're going to notice some interesting key signatures going on. We start out with five sharps, which can be a little bit daunting sometimes. And within that five-sharp key signature, we also see some double sharps happening, written in as accidentals. It's not too incredibly difficult, but it really is important to get those notes learned as quickly as possible. So obviously, if you're missing notes within the key signature, you're just going to have to go back and fix those again. So right off the bat, just make sure that you're really diligent in making sure that you're playing the right notes sharp, and the right notes natural, and the right notes double sharped when they're marked that way. There also are several key changes throughout the work. We move to two flats, four measures after rehearsal three. We move to three sharps, seven measures after rehearsal four. To four flats, two measures after rehearsal five. To three sharps, 7 measures before rehearsal 6, to 5 sharps, 6 measures after rehearsal 6, and then finally at the end of the work to 4 flats, 5 bars after rehearsal 9. So we have a lot of key signature changes. Just really make sure that you are aware of those when you're just initially taking a look at this piece, so that you're diligent in making sure that the right things are played the right way. Sharp, natural, flat, double sharp, whatever. So just don't let those get away from you, and don't start with bad habits of playing incorrect notes so that you have to go back and fix them later. The tempo marking is pretty slow. It's specifically marked as quarter note equaling 50. And it's also marked andantino languido, so it's supposed to be sort of on the slow side and to have this sort of languid character to it. It's really romantic in style, so you're going to see some tempo fluctuations. We see markings such as poco animato and tranquillo, and that's a specific piano section that we see after rehearsal 4. And we also have a brief cadenza written in as well. So all of these things sort of add that romantic character of a little bit of pushing and pulling as far as the tempo is concerned. I really like one aspect about this piece is the descending lines that we can see at the beginning. Now, you'll have to have your score in front of you so that you know what I'm talking about. But if you take a look at it, in the first 3 measures, we see this line happening, moving from D sharp to C double sharp to C sharp. So we have this descending half-step line that's going on. Now, these notes are not right next to each other. You have to pick them out in the measure, but you can sort of reduce that line down to those notes, and it's this really interesting sound. This same thing happens as well in measures 9 through 12. So we see an F sharp, an E sharp, an E natural, and a D sharp. So again, we get this descending chromatic line, which is really interesting, and seeing it a couple times, it just in the very opening of the piece shows us that this is not just something accidental, this is something deliberate, and it's really something that you can bring out to show us this continuous line that's happening. So that's a really neat aspect of this piece. The dynamics are really going to take special attention from you as a player because there are a lot of them. So we have a lot of quick, drastic changes, so quick crescendo followed by decrescendo, or some subito things that are not marked subito, but you might have a big crescendo and then suddenly a quiet dynamic written right next to it. So these happen occasionally. It's going to take some practice to get those shapes right. But because they're written in there, we know that the composer really intended to have that particular structure to the dynamics. So we want to make sure that we follow those strictly, because it really adds a lot to the performance. Obviously, you can play the notes, stick to the notes, but if you don't actually get the dynamics in there as well, it's going to fall a little bit flat. So you want to make sure that the dynamic shaping and contour is there to provide that interest. There's also that little cadenza that's written in. When I play this, I really don't deviate from what's written as far as note length or pacing or anything like that. If you take a look at the cadenza, it's clearly an ascending line, and so I try to show an increase in the energy and intensity of this piece as I move through that unaccompanied portion. So the piano does drop out at this section, comes in a little bit later towards the end of the cadenza where we have these trills. So after the fermata that occurs right before rehearsal 7, I leave a little bit of a dramatic silence. Now, it's probably only a second, but in performance it seems a lot longer, but I kind of let that last note just kind of fade away and just give it a second to settle, and then I come back in with that really quiet pianissimo D sharp. And really, this is the quietest dynamic marking that we have in this piece. It never goes below a pianissimo. So you really can exaggerate that as much as you want, and you're not going to be taking anything away from any other dynamic markings. So to me, that's really dramatic. It's a really juicy part of this piece, and so I really like to make that as quiet as I possibly can. As far as the peak of this piece, in my opinion, the peak happens 10 bars before rehearsal 9. At this section, it's marked with a fortissimo, relatively high. Might not be the exact highest note of this piece, but it is in the higher portion of our range, as far as the context of this piece is concerned. And the arrival here feels quite dramatic. There is a section that happens earlier in the piece, which is also marked fortissimo, and it is for a longer time, but it doesn't strike me as equally intense as this second section. It's definitely an important arrival, but the dynamic buildup happens over a longer period of time, which in this case makes it a little less intense. And the notes meander around, but they still kind of seem to stay in the same range. In the second section, it's winding down to the end of the piece, whereas this first section that's not quite as intense really settles into the tranquillo section where the piano plays, and then it keeps going for another page of music and several minutes that elapse. So to me, that second section is really the most dramatic peak that we have, and so if you can kind of structure your playing to reflect that, it usually comes across as a successful performance. Another thing that's really important with this piece is going to be embouchure flexibility. So it is very lyrical, very romantic, and because of that, we have a lot of slurs that are indicating the different phrases here. So you want to make sure that those slurs are really smooth and really executed well, and they're not always stepwise. So we do have some scales. We have, you know, just your typical stepwise motion, but occasionally there are going to be leaps that are under a slur, and so you have to make sure that your embouchure is flexible enough to navigate those jumps that we have under the slur. So we make sure we maintain that really lyrical, smooth sound that happens under those slurs. So this is a really nice piece. In performance, it comes across very well to the audience. It's something that's very audience-friendly. It's dramatic enough, it's romantic enough that it works very well. And it's a really nice opportunity to be really dramatic as well. So for me, that's a fun aspect of this piece, is to create a lot of drama through the dynamics, through the phrasing, through tone color and vibrato, obviously, things like that as well. But really a nice piece, and really one of my favorites to play. It's approximately 8 to 9 minutes long, depending on whether or not you strictly adhere to that slow 50 beats per minute tempo marking at the beginning of the piece. Flute World rates this as a 3, which is considered to be moderately difficult, suitable for high school students or early college. So hopefully you'll feel inclined to take a look at that piece and check it out and see if that's something that you can program at some point. Thanks so much for listening today. I'd love to hear from you with any questions or comments you may have. And if there are any specific flute works that are relatively new that you would like to know more about, please don't hesitate to contact me through my website, which again is www.tammyevansyant.com.